Hi there, this is Darren Spoo, pastor at First Baptist Church in Tulsa, and welcome to our weekly message podcast. We would invite you to join us in person Sunday morning at 8:30 and 11 o'clock in downtown Tulsa, or check out our webpage at tulsafbc.org. God bless you, and have a great week. Let's jump into our teaching time together, but first, I'm not going to make a lot of announcements today, but please know we have the offering boxes are in the window ledges. With those, more importantly, are our announcement sheets. And one thing that's not on the announcement sheet, I want us to take just a moment to celebrate. Last week, we did a meal packing event in which we prepared meals, vacuum-sealed meals for kids all over the planet to feed those who are in the hungriest of conditions. So last week, together, our church packaged 101,088 meals. Can we celebrate that for just a moment? And that's enough to feed about 275 kids for an entire year. Yeah. If you don't know Baptists, we don't know when to clap. It always starts awkwardly, like we don't know exactly what to do. Also, one thing that is on your announcement sheet, and I realize every Easter Sunday morning there's some folks who are here for the very first time. Maybe you were brought here against your will. You didn't really want to come to church today. Or maybe it's been a long time since you've been in church. I would ask you just to look at that very top announcement. I'm doing a one-off session at the end of next month called Considering Christianity. And I think there are a lot of misconceptions about Christianity, so in this 45-minute time together, I'm just going to lay out, here's the very simple rudiments of our faith. But also, I think there's many people who have misconceptions or objections, rather, to Christianity. And so as an outflow of that class, I want to put a book into your hand that will help walk through some of these objections. You know, one reason that people reject Christianity is because of the Crusades. You know, they don't even know what the Crusades are, but you know, it wasn't good, and I'm going to reject Christianity because it's violent. Well, this is something to think through what you've been taught and what you believe and who God really is. And I'm glad you're here today. So here's where I want to start. I love trivia. I love finding those little statistics and those little facts and those stories that sound so wild, and sometimes they're not true, so you have to do a little research. But whenever I come across a really interesting fact, that's where I start first. Is it true? And then if it is true, I like to ask the question, what does this mean? Because often with strange stories, there's just something lurking underneath the surface that is very interesting if you stop and think about it. So here's what I found. 2 weeks ago, my wife and I were sitting together reading. I was reading through a trivia book. I came across something. I couldn't believe it. So I ripped it out to put it in a file. And she goes, what are you ripping up your book for? And I said, Pet, you know, mind your own business is what I said. No, I didn't say that. I said, well, I found something here that I just don't know if this is true or not. Let me research it really quick. And it was about the longest known human pregnancy. Okay. Now, you know, a woman when she's pregnant is 40 weeks. Okay. That's about 280 days. But there is a woman named Beulah Howard in 1945 that, get this, was pregnant for 1 year, 1 week. Okay, I expected a collective moan at that moment. 375 days she was pregnant in total. And number one, I made sure it was true, and it has been verified. It seems that something unusual happened. By the way, here was her prognosis. It was called a prodigious pregnancy. Whatever that is, I don't want it, okay? So at some point, about 6 months, her pregnancy just paused, and the baby was static for a time, and then it started regrowing, and so she was pregnant for over a year. Now, it turns out that that is true. My wife said, well, what does that mean? And I told her this. I said, that means that when you've been pregnant, you've had it easy, sister. Yeah, that's what it means. Was that the wrong thing to say? Probably not that. I'm not very good at relationships. That's why I became a pastor. So I said, here's what I think it means. I said, I need to think about this a little bit more, but I think it just means something like this. Sometimes things just take longer than what you expect them to take. Sometimes things just take longer than what you expect them to take. And here's what I want to do. With the resurrection accounts of Jesus today, I want to take one account. I kind of want to rip it out of the page of the Bible and say, let's look at this story because this is true. And as we look at this one resurrection account, I want to ask the question, what does this mean? And you can read along if you want to. I'll be in John 21, the very last chapter of the last gospel. But I would prefer today if you just listened. Just listen to this account. Listen to this story. Let yourself be present in this moment, in this room, and imagine yourself even being there during this event. So here's the backstory. You probably know this. Jesus was born, lived 30 years, three-year ministry in which he proclaimed himself to be the light of the world. He taught, he healed, he brought about miracles. And just when you thought you couldn't get any better, it got worse. And Jesus got crossways with the religious and political forces of his day, and he was murdered on trumped-up charges. And he was dead. To make this even more tragic, two of the 12 men that Jesus had handpicked let him down in an unbelievable way. Judas denied Jesus. He turned into an informant and let them know where Jesus was so that Jesus could be arrested. That was Judas. Peter was one who said, "Lord, I'm going to stick up for you no matter if all these other schlups, you know, give way. I'm never going to deny you." Well, he did, not once, not twice, but three times. He said he would stand up for Jesus, but Peter was like the rest of us. He just mostly wanted to save his own skin. So, can you imagine being Peter? The last interaction you had with the man that you loved, that you called Lord, you denied him, and Jesus knew it. In fact, he and Peter locked eyes right before Jesus' crucifixion, and Peter knew that he had let his master down. Can you imagine the guilt, the shame, the regret? Well, now, Jesus is resurrected. On that first day of the week, on Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, Jesus comes out of the grave and he starts appearing to people, which is good news. But think about this. First, he appears to Mary. And by the way, in Jesus' day, a woman's testimony was not even presentable, admissible in court. Okay. So if your disciples manufacturing a detail, you probably wouldn't have the first resurrection account, the first witness be a woman. But that just, it happened that way, and that's the way it really happened. And Mary could be trusted with what she said. He is risen. So then Jesus starts appearing to a few other people. He appears to two travelers on a road to Emmaus. He appears to Thomas, who's known as Doubting Thomas. He appears to all these people. In fact, depending on how you look at this, Jesus had seven different appearances, and the one person he didn't appear to was Peter. Now, Peter was in a group when Jesus appeared, but Jesus went out of his way to deal with Doubting Thomas, and it seems like Jesus is now ignoring Peter. Well, maybe sometimes things just take a little longer than what you would expect. So this is the account from John 21. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. Here were the disciples that were there. There were seven. Simon Peter, okay, he's there. Thomas, who is known as Didymus. By the way, Didymus means twin. So Thomas's nickname was Ditto. I just love that. I love those little character twist right there. What's up, Ditto? Call somebody that this week, okay? Nathanael from Canaan in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, that was James and John. Verse 3, I'm going out to fish. Actually, what Peter says here, grammatically in the Greek, it's I'm going back to fishing. He was a fisherman when Jesus found him. He had spent 3 years with Jesus. He was now frustrated. Jesus had appeared so many times, hadn't appeared to Peter. Maybe, you know what? Judas had committed suicide. There was no hope for him. Maybe there's no hope for me as well. I'm going back to fishing. The other disciples said, we'll go with you. But that night, they caught nothing. Now, I believe what's contained here is a literal story. But I also think it's a lived parable. That there's something here that's worth paying attention to that's just deeper than the actual events. This fishing expedition on this night was pretty much a recapsuling of everything that Peter had experienced the last 3 years. Started with great enthusiasm following Jesus and ended in frustration. Well, that's exactly what happened this night. Great enthusiasm, let's go out to fish. Nighttime was a great time to fish. And they ended up empty-handed. Enthusiasm turned to frustration. By the way, if there's a problem in your life today, and I don't know anybody who doesn't have a problem in their life today, It boils down to one of four causes. It's either you caused it, someone else, another person, you didn't ask for it, but another person caused this problem. Third, God has introduced this problem into your life in order to refine you. Or fourth, Satan has initiated this problem in your life in order to destroy you. Here's the challenge. In the middle of the event, it's hard to tell who's responsible, okay? It's hard to tell what is the actual cause of this. So if I'm Peter, I go, yeah, I brought this all on myself. But could it be that God actually introduced this problem in Peter's life to help redefine who he was? Could it be that Satan wanted to take advantage? In fact, Jesus said as much. Peter, Satan, he wants to sift you like wheat. Okay. It's hard to tell who is exactly responsible right in the middle of all of this. All Peter knew is that he was guilty, he was ashamed, and he was filled with regret. Okay. Now, verse 4, early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore. But the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, friends, haven't you caught any fish? That's a terrible thing to ask a fisherman when he's come up empty. Have you caught any fish? Nope, they answered. And he said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. And when they did, they were unable to haul the net because it had such a large number of fish. Now, again, this is a literal event, but I think there's some parable qualities to this. Notice for the disciples, they couldn't see below the surface and they couldn't see to the shore. Think about this for just a minute. From where they were, they couldn't see below the surface of things. All they could see was the surface of the water. Jesus, from his standpoint, and some fishermen can read the surface of the water and tell where schools of fish are. So whether Jesus was doing that or miraculous means, Jesus could see below the surface where the disciples couldn't. That's exactly how many of us live. We live like a rock, skipping across the water from one event to another, never looking below the surface. Things deeper are happening. In your life right now, even if it's boring, even if it's brutal, things are happening below the surface that you can't see. Maybe we should pay a little more attention. But not only could the disciples not see below the surface, they couldn't see to the shore. In other words, the disciples could not see who it was that was standing right in front of them. I love the old account of Native Americans. One of the things that they would often do when a young brave was becoming a warrior, he had to go through a rite of passage to become a man. One thing they would do oftentimes is they would put that young man in the woods by himself for one night. No fire, no light, no warmth, no nothing. Now up to this time, he had always been around his mother, his father, his cousins, his brothers, his sisters. There had always been that warmth of community. Now he's by himself, one dark night, all alone. Every twig that snaps has got to be an animal. Every howl he hears feels like it's right next to him. At the end of this terror-stricken night, as the darkness begins to turn to dawn, the young warrior would see a figure standing not 10 yards away. And you know who it was? It was his father standing there with a bow and arrow. He had been watching over his son all night long. Listen, at the time when God feels the furthest, he's actually the closest. Just because you can't see him doesn't mean he isn't there. But we're like those disciples. We can't see below the surface, and often we can't see who's standing right in front of us. Okay? Verse 7, well, the disciple whom Jesus loved. By the way, this is John's gospel. Every time John refers to himself, he says, the disciple who Jesus loved the most. You know, I don't know if your kids ever have that discussion about which one that you love the most. But he goes, you know, the disciple who Jesus loved the most, me, turned to Peter and said, it's the Lord. Now get what happens. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it's the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him because he had taken it off. Now, men in that day would wear a one-piece garment, and they would have a belt in the middle. And so when they were fishing or doing tough manual labor, they would take the top of it off and just let it hang down over the belt. So as Peter contemplates jumping in the water and swimming toward Jesus, he wants to get there as quickly as possible. So he pulls this outer garment up and over to reduce the drag because he's got to get to Jesus. This has taken longer than what I expected it to take. Enough is enough. So the other disciples, they follow in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, there was already a fire, there was fish and bread. And Jesus said to them, and Peter got there first, but we don't know what was said, if anything. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you caught. So Simon Peter climbed back in the boat and dragged the net ashore, a large number of fish, 153 in all. Now, a lot of scholars have gone, why do they mention this number here, 153? Why mention the exact number of fish? Here's why. Because they're fishermen. It's pretty simple. Have you ever known a fisherman go, yeah, I don't know how much we caught this weekend? Yeah, they do. It's like me being a pastor. I count people. So, I mean, I can tell you right now, there's 5,000 people in this room right now, you know? Except this was no exaggeration. This was about as much as the net would hold, 153. Now do the math on it, and it's probably about 250, 300 pounds. Jesus says, bring some fish. Peter's all over it. He jumps up, grabs that whole net. Now probably some other disciples chipped in, but he was going to haul that net on shore, whether he had to do it by himself or not. He was trying everything he could to get Jesus' attention. This has taken longer than what I expected this to take. Jesus, I need to talk with you. We gotta figure this out. So Jesus said in verse 12, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? Because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus took the bread, gave it to them, same with the fish. It says, now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples. Now, he had appeared on more occasions, but collectively, this is the third time Jesus appeared to a group of his disciples. So I don't know how to interpret this breakfast. Was it an awkward silence? I don't know how many of you just can't stand the sound of other people chewing? Am I the only one? I mean, I don't mind mine. In fact, it sounds delicious. Yeah. But everyone else's chewing kind of frustrates me. And there's no dialogue that happens here. So that tells me that Jesus sitting around this fire with his disciples, can you imagine eight men chomping on fish? Fish bones. I think it was an awkward silence, but it was also an awestruck silence. He's here. Just as we had a final meal with him before he died, now we're having breakfast with him. After all this, it's him. I'd love to know what was happening in the internal monologue. This will blow your mind. David Brooks says that we have an internal monologue that operates at the speed, get this, of 4,000 words a minute. Could you imagine somebody typing 4,000 words a minute? That's what's going on in your brain. Their brains were full. This is the Lord. What do we do? What do we say? It was overwhelming. This was him. He's here. And then that moment that Peter had been waiting for. After breakfast, I wonder if Jesus just kind of laid a hand on his shoulder. Come with me. When they'd finished eating, Jesus said, Simon, son of John. How many of you still cringe at the thought of your mom or dad saying your full name? Simon, son of John. Do you really love me more than these? You said you love me more than all these other disciples. Do you really? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Feed my lambs. Get this. This had to be a shock to Peter. He was expecting to have the responsibility of his failure laid on him, but instead of the responsibility of his failure, he's given a responsibility to lead now. It's almost as though Jesus was saying, okay, now that you've reached the end of yourself, now that you've failed miserably, now you're actually ready for me to make something of your life. It oftentimes takes us getting to the end of ourselves before the Lord will really use us. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Take care of my sheep. A third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And it says Peter was hurt because the Lord asked a third time. Why was he hurt? Because he finally understood what Jesus was doing. Three times Peter had denied Christ. And now three times, Jesus works to restore Peter. And this cut to the knife, but it also had to feel marvelous. So I'm going to begin a new teaching series next week. And actually, it begins today. I'm just not promoting it like this, but I'm going to do a teaching series on loneliness. I think loneliness is the true pandemic that we are living through right now. It's given rise to so much mental illness. It's hard on our bodies. It's hard on our minds. I think people are more prone to conspiracy theories when they feel alone and isolated. But Peter is a quintessential example of how our past can make us feel alone. He was swamped with guilt. Guilt is realizing the responsibilities of your past sins and failures. He was just swimming in guilt. Not only did he have this sense of responsibility for his past, and that was guilt, I think Peter was ashamed. Now, shame is different than guilt. Guilt is, I'm responsible. Shame is, this is who I am now. And whatever that failure is, it now defines your very character. Also, it's guilt, shame, regret. Peter says, as much as I want to travel back in time and make it right, I just can't do it. So, I don't want to bore you with the definition of loneliness, which is pretty much a sign that I'm about to bore you with the definition of loneliness. But loneliness is very simply this. It's the gap between the affection you want and the infection you have. Or you can use the word intimacy. It's the gap between the intimacy that you want and the intimacy you have. And that gap in there, that's where loneliness takes place. Peter was lonely for Jesus. I want to be close to you again. This is taking longer than I would expect it to take. Well, yeah, sometimes it does. And yes, Peter, and by the way, as I'm talking to Peter, I'm really talking to you. You can't change your past, but God can transform your past into something different. So I was in Edinburgh, Scotland a few weeks ago. I was in what we would call a projects. There they call it a scheme. I was in the projects, pretty rough public housing. Those who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, but if you went even one step down from there and you had no family, no friends, no resources, they'd put you in this big apartment complex about 20 stories high, just kind of off sitting by itself. And the nickname that this project had for that apartment complex, again, it just looms large over everything. It's called Heartbreak Hotel. Because people who are moved there by themselves are 20 times more likely to commit suicide than the other people living in the projects. Loneliness is an epidemic in our culture. And a lot of it has to go back to guilt and shame and regret. Imagine this. So I love the Apollo story, the moon landing. Do you know where there's a plan if Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, if they got to the moon and the Eagle lander did not take off from the surface of the moon? They didn't know it had never been, it had been tested, but it had never been tried real time on the moon. Would the lander take off? If it didn't, these two men would be stranded on the moon forever. And so the plan was to contact the would-be widows, let them know first, let them call their husbands, say their goodbyes. A chaplain would pretty much read last rites, and then communication to the moon would then be cut off. Just imagine that for a moment, to be a world away and to be cut off and left alone to die. Maybe some of you here in this room don't have to imagine that feeling. Maybe you know exactly what that feels like. Is there any hope? As Jesus allows Peter to walk with him, he slowly invites Peter to reaffirm his love for him. And then, after talking about Peter's future, Jesus gives this command. Listen to this. He says, Peter, now follow me. And actually, in the Greek, it carries with it the continual, keep on following me. Yes, you cannot change the past, but I can transform your past. Whereas before there's been guilt, you're forgiven. Now there should be gratitude. Whereas before there was shame, this failure no longer needs to define you. Now there can be something called salvation. Now, here's the part I really want you to listen to, because as I read the Bible, I make it a point to look for patterns. If I go all the way back to Genesis, I see a pattern. God created all things with his word, except you and me. When he created humanity, he didn't use his words. He used his hands, and he formed Adam and Eve. Then he put them into a garden where they failed spectacularly. And just when you think things can't get worse, they do. In Genesis 4, after they've been expelled from the garden, now there's murder. Cain kills Abel, and Cain is sent even further away from God's presence, but he's not sent out scot-free. He's given a mark. We don't know what it is. He said, but Cain, from now on, you are a marked man. Think about that pattern. And think about this. So Jesus chose 12 disciples. He handpicked them. And then Jesus went into a garden where he did not fail. In fact, where Adam and Eve failed, he marvelously succeeded. Father, not my will, but your will be done. That's what Adam and Eve should have done. That's what Jesus did. But then things took a turn for the worst, and just as there was murder after the garden, now there was denial after the garden, and Peter is a marked man. But he's not marked by his failure. He's not marked by guilt and shame and regret. He's marked, get this, by forgiveness. He receives a very different mark that now defines who he is for the rest of his life. Is he perfect? No, he's forgiven. Is he faultless? No, he's forgiven. Has he dealt with sin and shame and guilt and regret? Yes, but that does not define who he really is, because God can take that and transform it by the mark of forgiveness. I've so much enjoyed this Holy Week. In fact, of the 30 years I've been a pastor, this has been my favorite week, because we made an offer, and if you've been around here the last couple of weeks, the offer was, if you want to reaffirm your baptismal vows, I invite you to come to the church, and we'll gather here in the corridor, and you can remember that baptism. Some people were baptized for the first time this week, but about 36 folks took up this opportunity just to reaffirm their love for God. Now, here's what I noticed. What struck me was not the 36 people who decided to do this. What struck me was the variety of people who decided to do this. The youngest was 17. The oldest was 81. That's old, folks. You know what? Hey, you can laugh a little bit at that, but get this. Age is never considered a curse in the Bible. Age is always considered a blessing. So when I say that's old, God has blessed this person. There have been people who are blue collar. There are people who are white collar. There are people who are no collar. There were a few people who are homeless or nearly homeless. There were some who are highly successful. There were many who just had this secret guilt from their past that they finally needed to confess and let go of. And there were some who just said, I don't know why I need to do this, but I need to do this. What all of these people affirm is a need that we all know that we have deep down. Here's the need. The need of forgiveness. To no longer be defined by our guilt, in our shame, in our regret, but be defined by the one who invites you even today, follow me. So I don't know what you're holding on to, if you're holding on to anything, but maybe this has taken longer than what you thought it would to let go of it. My encouragement, see below the surface of things, and today, would you see who's standing right in front of you? And he invites you to follow him. Let's stand together and let's pray together this morning.
Thanks so much for listening to our weekly message podcast. At the end of each worship service on Sunday morning, I offer a simple blessing, and I offer that blessing to you today. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you, and may God grant you peace, both now and forever. Amen.